From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Hundreds of people are under quarantine today on the campuses of UCLA and Cal State Los Angeles after two students infected with measles came in contact with hundreds of students and staff. About 700 measles cases have been reported across 22 states now. It is the largest outbreak since measles was eradicated in the United States 19 years ago. President Trump today called on people to get vaccinated.
They have to get the shot. The vaccinations are so important. This is really going around now. They have to get their shots.
Dr. Robert Redfield is the director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Doctor, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And how will this quarantine in California work, and what will you be watching for over the next several days?
Well, the decisions on how to try to limit the spread are obviously local decisions that are made. It's not uncommon for college campuses then to try to identify individuals that have been exposed and to try to request that those individuals stay limited into their rooms. The problem with measles is that it is highly, highly infectious. And the challenge is that it's highly infectious 3-4 days prior to getting any symptoms in the rash.
So some of these students and faculty might have to stay sequestered up to several days, it sounds like. At what point can they be cleared?
Well, it really does take about 2 weeks on average from the time you're exposed to measles to the time that you may actually develop clinical symptoms of measles. So in general, we recommend that individuals that have been exposed not circulate for up to 21 days.
How concerned are you, generally speaking, about this outbreak?
Well, we think this is a very serious situation. It does have the potential to regain a foothold in the United States and then, you know, put us back to have to renew efforts to once again try to eradicate it.
And it's deadly. I mean, right? It's probably worth pointing out that this is not like the chicken pox.
Now, this disease does have mortality associated with it, usually in a well-nourished population, probably in the order of 1 to 1,000 can actually die, but many can actually get serious pneumonias or serious encephalitis, which would potentially have serious long-term sequelae. So it's a serious infection.
We heard the president at the White House say today that people should get their measles shot. But in 2014, he tweeted out a conspiracy theory. He wrote that a healthy young child goes to the doctor, gets pumped with massive shot of many vaccines, doesn't feel good, and changes. Autism, many such cases. Doctor, that came from the man who is now the president of the United States. Isn't it messages like that that got us into this dangerous situation?
I'm really happy that the president came out today to recommend people get vaccinated. I think it's very important. We can say, and I can say as the director of CDC, that vaccination does not cause autism. It's really important. I think the key message is that right now about 94% of parents vaccinate their children. We want to get that last 6% to vaccinate their children. I think the key area there is some people are sort of the worried well. They don't want to make a mistake that might harm their children. And our message is that these vaccines are safe. They do not cause autism. Others have really gotten disinformation, as you mentioned, from groups that promote anti-vaccination.
And those messages are the same ones that the president was writing about in 2014, correct?
I can't really comment about that. As I said, I'm very excited to hear the president come out this morning and remind the American public that it's important they get vaccination. WHO this year did something really that's unprecedented. They actually listed vaccine hesitancy as one of the 10 major global health threats that the world faces today. And so, again, our message, the president's message this morning, was to get vaccinated.
And this outbreak was caused, I just want to be clear, by people failing to get vaccinated because the vaccination rate was falling. Does that sound right?
What's happened in this case were the three major outbreaks we have, two in New York and the one in Washington, they really started from individuals who traveled abroad, where you wouldn't think if I'm going to go to Europe on vacation, I have to worry about I might get measles. But the reality is you do have to worry. that you might get measles. And the reason you might get measles in Europe is because there are lower vaccination rates, and measles is circulating right now in Europe. It's circulating in the Middle East. It's circulating in Africa. Actually, in the last year and a half, 2 years, we've had a 300% increase in new measles case on a globally. And so this is why we really encourage people that before they're going to travel, make sure they're vaccinated, particularly against measles. And you are right, how this got a foothold is, unfortunately, we have pockets of individuals who have chosen not to get vaccinated. And we're going to continue to encourage people to please, please reconsider, take advantage of vaccines, not just for measles, because I think measles is sort of the canary in the mine, that there are other vaccine-preventable diseases that we could see reemerging if people don't take advantage of the vaccines that are available for to prevent these infections that once were commonplace.
That's Dr. Robert Redfield, the director of the Centers for Disease Control. Doctor, thanks for your time. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, the conversation about measles is sure to continue on social media, but let's see what else is trending with Femi Okeh, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English. Hi, Femi.
Hello there, Jeremy. Hello, Peter.
Hello.
So one of the top picks in the NFL draft, Nick Bosa of Ohio State University, went to the San Francisco 49ers last night after his agent recently scrubbed his social media accounts of all controversial posts and likes about political and racial subjects. Bosa addressed a group of reporters about the deleted tweets last night.
I've learned from it. I was insensitive in some of the things I was saying, and I'm glad to be moving on from it, and I'm excited to start with the Niners.
Femi, what was he saying online that was drawing this criticism?
Well, Nick Bosa, he's a very enthusiastic supporter of President Trump. He's very comfortable sharing his conservative views. He's posted criticism about things, you know, pop culture things like the Black Panther, Beyonce, back a couple of years ago when he was a teenager. So teenage boy on Twitter, normal sort of things that you expect to see. For instance, when Lemonade was all the rage, that's Beyonce's big song that came out in March 2016, he said, "Beyonce's music is complete trash. The song Lemonade is pretty much a transcript of Democrat Twitter." That's his opinion. No harm there, perhaps. He's also liked viewpoints like build a wall, crime will fall, no more refugees, Obama is doing nothing. So you can see where his political stance actually is when he's actually operating on Twitter. More problematic, though, when he starts talking about particular NFL players.
Like Colin Kaepernick, who we call the clown.
For instance, yes. Two Colin Kaepernick tweets from August 2016 from Nick Bosa. Kaepernick is a clown and Krapernick is the reason ratings are down. Now, he scrubbed his account. He's got rid of all of these tweets. Why are we able to still read them? Well, that's because whenever you're a high-profile person, somebody of note, there is a likelihood that someone will screen grab your tweets and save them for later, which is exactly what happened to him.
Which they did. Now, if you're a fan of the 49ers, a lot of them weren't pleased, but, you know, some of his teammates actually did welcome him to the squad. So anyways, there's that. But I want to ask you about another question, another story. An African-American man recently shared a photo of himself wearing a bandage that matched the color of his skin. It got a pretty viral, bittersweet reaction. Femi, tell us more about that.
I'm looking at it right now. Let me describe it for you. It's Dominic Apollon, and he's taking a hand selfie, and one is far away and his hand looks perfectly fine, and then one is very close up, and then you see very discreetly there's a band-aid on, but it's a deep dark brown band-aid. And he says that this was a moment for him. 45 trips around the sun, but for the first time in my life, I know what it's like to have a band-aid in my own skin tone. So you can barely even spot it in the first image. For real, I'm holding back tears. That seemed like a really extreme reaction to something as simple as a band-aid, but it's the idea of skin tone, matching your skin tone, whatever colour you happen to be. And lots of people actually weighed up on that. A.B. Williams says, "It is indeed mind-boggling. It took so long, embarrassingly long." From A.B. Williams' Twitter profile, I am guessing that A.B. Williams is actually Caucasian. And then lots of people of colour said that it actually changed their lives.
Wow.
Okay.
And
Femi, I just want to get to one more thing in the last minute
we
have.
Go ahead. Okay. Femi, I can hear you.
Merriam-Webster
to do the next story.
Has added hundreds of new words to its dictionary, and somebody already wrote a song about them. Listen.
All right.
Buzzy, gender, nonconforming, garbage time, snowflake, bioabsorbable. I now live in a purple state. Top surgery.
Okay. A lot of new words, Femi. Real quick, what are your thoughts?
Need some pictures, please. It's about time. The words that we use every day, and we think, oh, snowflake. That's bound to be in the dictionary. Snowflake.
I've never
new
used
meaning
traumatology.
For snowflake. Page view. Why is that page not already view. In the dictionary?
Right.
And then, of course, some words from our time that are very present in the way that we are managing in the world and our society. Things like gender nonconforming.
Right.
I think that's really important that is in the dictionary. It is a thing, and it's something that we're grappling with. Many, many more. Go to Merriam-Webster Dictionary. It's one of the most fun online accounts that you can actually follow. And it's all about words.
Femi OK, host of The Stream on Al Jazeera English. Femi, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy and Peter.
When it comes to train rides, delays are not the best news. But there is another delay in the construction of a huge new train line in London, a city known for its extensive underground railway.
This station is London Bridge. Change here for the Northern Line and National Rail Services.
The London Tube is the oldest underground rail network in the world, but it's also very crowded. More than 5 million people use the Tube every day, and at peak hours, up to 543 trains are zipping below one of the world's busiest cities. That's why Londoners have been anxiously waiting for the Crossrail project to be finished. Crossrail is one of Europe's biggest infrastructure projects, a $17 billion moonshot that will cut down travel times across the city and bring relief to commuters. The project is held in such high esteem that 2 years ago, Crossrail was renamed the Elizabeth Line in honor of the Queen. Claire Perry was a minister for the Department of Transport. She made the announcement before the House of Commons in 2016.
She has long been associated with many aspects of this nation's transport. Our Queen opened the Victoria Line service in 1969. The Fleet Line was renamed the Jubilee Line in honour of her first 25 years on the throne in 1979. And she is the first reigning monarch, Mr. Speaker, to travel on the London Underground.
But the Queen will have to wait to ride the Elizabeth Line. It was originally scheduled to open last year. That was pushed back to December of this year. And this week, we learned it may not open until the spring of 2021. Engineers are struggling to link up the train software with the network's signaling. They've also fallen behind on installing communication systems in the stations. That includes more than 24 miles of cables, hundreds of cameras, and radio antennas. Last November, when we broadcast Here and Now from London, I met Howard Smith, the director of operations at Crossrail's high-rise offices in London's Canary Wharf neighborhood, and I asked him what the vision for the project was.
So the Elizabeth Line's about physically building some new tunnels, so about 14, 15 miles of new tunnels across the centre of London, right through the heart of London. But those tunnels actually connect up the existing lines that run to the mainline termini in London. So for hundreds of years, well over 100 years, people in London, in fact, in most European cities, have been used to coming to the edge of town in a big train above the surface and then doing something that's very odd when you think about it, which is to go on an escalator down and get in a small train to finish off the journey across the centre of London. And that's because over 100 years ago, you couldn't easily build tunnels because it was steam trains. They don't fit very well with tunnels. And also, there was a law that stopped railways coming into the very centre of London.
And it will go from where to where?
The Elizabeth Line in total will connect Heathrow Airport, the West End, the area just used for the Olympics at Stratford. So all of London's major areas all connected up on one new line.
So give us an example. Americans, if they've come to London before, they've probably flown into Heathrow Airport and they know that right now, if you were to get on the Tube and come into London, it could take you almost an hour to get into the center of the city, 45 minutes to an hour, something like that. You can also take this fast Heathrow Express train that will get you to Paddington Station in about 20 minutes from Heathrow, but then you've got to get to your next destination. If you are taking Crossrail, the Elizabeth Line, how long is it going to take you to get from Heathrow Airport to the centre of London?
Just over half an hour. So to get from Heathrow to somewhere like
Canary
Wharf.
Let's say Piccadilly Circus, even.
Piccadilly Circus, just over half an hour.
Wow.
So you come into Tottenham Court Road, that would be less than half an hour, one change from there. If you were coming to Canary Wharf, right over the other side of town, at the moment that would take you nearly an hour. That will take you about 40 minutes.
And how did you build these tunnels without disrupting the city? If you tried to do this in a U.S. city, people would be complaining that there would be traffic nightmares all over the place to build the tunnels.
Well, the tunnels that have been dug across London are fairly deep. They're not cut-and-cover tunnels where you go down from the surface. They're actually used tunnel boring machines. Mm-hmm. There were eight huge 100-metre-long factories underground tunnelling under London. So they're about 30, 40 metres below the ground. The reason they're able to get through and have a good alignment is because actually the route has been protected under planning regulations for decades.
Hmm.
So the route was planned, and then the tunnel boring machines set off from the edge of town and essentially work towards each other.
How long did it take, though, to do that?
It took about 4 years to do the tunneling.
Those tunneling machines weighed 1,000 tons each and had very dignified names like Victoria, Phyllis, and Sophia. When they were finally done chewing up the clay below London in 2015, Prime Minister David Cameron went underground to mark the occasion.
This feat, boring 26 miles underneath the streets of London, it ranks alongside the Channel Tunnel, it ranks alongside the Great Western Railway line. It's an engineering triumph, and everyone who's been involved should be hugely proud.
I asked Howard Smith how many things the machines ran into along the way.
In terms of tunneling, incredibly very, very little in the way. And that's down to the planning that's been done over the years. So if you're building a big building, you're not allowed to do it on the route. If you're putting something in the ground, you have to take it back out. So there were a couple of incidents where tunnel boring machines actually came into contact with things that had been placed in the ground decades ago and weren't known about. Or little parts of the route had sand or water. But tunneling these days, the engineers are incredibly clever. And actually, you can get around most of that.
But how, for all those many decades, were those routes able to be preserved and somebody didn't come along and say, oh, they're never going to build this thing. We can put this building right on top of this route. It'll be really great for us up here above ground.
Crossrail's been under planning, depending on how you want to call it, for over a century. The Regent's Canal Company actually had plans for an east-west railway across London back in the 19th century. Something called the Abercrombie Report at the end of the Second World War laid out London's future transport links and included something that we'd recognise as Crossrail today. So actually, the history of these things, even things like the Channel Tunnel, are that the good ideas don't go away.
What has been the biggest challenge of Crossrail?
Many challenges in Crossrail, and I've been on the project for about 15 years. Probably the first one was actually to get £15 billion together, jointly funded by the city and by government, huge challenge. And then the real difficult bit, but I'm slightly biased as the operator at the end of it, is actually bringing all the pieces together. So something as complicated that connects up existing railways, brand new railways, new systems, mm-hmm. old systems, that's the real challenge at the end of the job.
Now, we're here in November of 2018. This was supposed to open next month, right? So why the delay? Why is it not until next year?
The hardest part of the job is to bring all of it together. So old and new systems, the train, the signalling, there's three different sorts of signalling. So you have to bring those together and test them. And nobody wants to open something that isn't reliable. You would never open something that wasn't safe.
Right.
So we're continuing to test. We've got trains running up and down in the tunnels.
Already, they're in the tunnels.
At the time,
running.
The first train went through actually in June, from end to end in June this year.
Mm-hmm.
But continuing to test individual trains, then groups of trains, then bring the staff in, and then test passengers.
How do you test passengers? Do you hire actors?
We bring in passengers. A lot of our friends and relations, I suspect, when the time comes.
Friends and family.
Exactly. As was done many years ago, for instance, on the Channel Tunnel. And you bring them in, and if you want to practice getting them on and off trains, even a small number of them, actually taking them off trains in tunnels. That's how you do it.
Now, you might hear this and think, why doesn't my city do something like Crossrail? The U.S. has never invested in passenger trains the way other developed countries have. Phase one of the Second Avenue subway in Manhattan took about 100 years to pull off. It cost $4.5 billion to build 2 miles of track and three stations. So what's the difference?
Lines like this, really big, high-capacity, expensive lines, only make sense in really big cities. Mm-hmm. So that narrows down the field a bit.
Right.
And the other challenge, which does apply in Europe, but perhaps not quite as much as it does in North America, is actually bringing the various funding streams together. In North America, you end up having to assemble a huge number of different funding streams that often take long time to bring together because they're dependent on different politicians.
And you didn't have to do that.
We had to do that for Crossrail, but we had to do that simply between the London mayor and the government.
The Elizabeth Line will end up taking more than a decade to build when it finally opens. By all accounts, it will be a huge upgrade to an already impressive transportation system. But will it be good enough for Londoners?
Londoners, and I speak as a lifelong Londoner, will always find something that isn't quite to their liking in London's transport. I would say in the 30-odd years that I've worked on public transport in London, people's expectations have risen, but actually I think people's understanding of the complexities has risen too. So there'll always be things that people don't like, but I think they'll love the Elizabeth Line when it opens.
We'll see. Like Brexit, Crossrail has been delayed. It was supposed to be up and running in December of this year, but now that has been pushed back to the spring of 2021. And by the way, on the subject of Brexit, talks have apparently stalled between Prime Minister Theresa May and the opposition Labour Party. That means the UK will take part in European parliamentary elections on May 23rd. The new deadline for Britain to leave the EU is October 31st. So happy Halloween.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, EmberWave. EmberWave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. EmberWave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave. Control your comfort.
It's been 48 years since the Milwaukee Bucks have won an NBA championship. But fans hope that long drought will end this year. On Sunday, the Bucks enter round two of the Eastern Conference playoffs against the Boston Celtics. Chuck Quirnbach from member station WUWM reports.
It was April 30, 1971, when the Milwaukee Bucks closed out their championship series sweep of the Baltimore Bullets. A retrospective produced by the team includes announcer Eddie Doucette's radio call on that long-ago night.
Run, he hits it. It's over! It's over! The Milwaukee Bucks are champions of the world!
Bruce Jeske, now in his early 60s, remembers the 1971 team winning it all.
The city just loved it. They embraced it. But unfortunately, it was only the 1 year, but I don't know how it crumbled.
The Bucks didn't exactly crumble. They made it to the NBA Finals again in 1974, losing to the Celtics in seven games. Then there was some crumbling. Team legends Oscar Robertson and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar either retired or demanded to be traded. The Bucks have been good off and on since then, but haven't made it back to the Finals. They're hoping their new stars get them there. The Bucks' brightest star and possible league MVP this season is Giannis Antetokounmpo. Earlier this year, the 6'11" forward dribbled a ball in a nearly empty practice gym with the media watching. It was part of a promotional event for a children's charity, the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Antetokounmpo, sometimes troubled by a sore knee and ankle, even dunked to impress the 12-year-old boy who was his guest. The 24-year-old Antetokounmpo, born in poverty in Athens, Greece, and sometimes referred to as the Greek freak, then told reporters it's important to help children.
And at the end of the day, you know, when you look back, you're going to remember all these moments, you know, that you were able to help kids and make kids' day special.
Antetokounmpo's friendliness and generosity appear genuine, and fans have responded in kind. as the Bucks finished off the Detroit Pistons in Detroit this week in round one of the playoffs. Fans watching those display screens in Milwaukee showered praise on Antetokounmpo, who scored 41 points that night. MVP! 27-year-old Tony Scaife says he's ready to move on from Robertson and Abdul-Jabbar being the faces of Bucks championships.
Yeah, it's time. I think Giannis time now. I think it's the Greek Freak's time now, so...
But first, there are more playoff series to win, starting with the Celtics. Boston defeated Milwaukee in the 1974 finals, and the Celtics have knocked the Bucks out of the playoffs in other years, including last year. Fan Andre Lee says he hopes the Bucks' fortunes have changed.
We sweep in Boston.
Why do you say that?
Well, because, in fact, Boston really ain't got no big man that can handle Giannis. Flat out.
And he may be right. Antetokounmpo averaged about 30 points a game against the Celtics this year, and the Bucks bested Boston in two of the three regular season matchups. For Here and Now, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
And Chuck mentioned the 1974 loss against the Celtics in the finals. Well, Celtics star John Havlicek received the Most Valuable Player award in that series. Yesterday, Havlicek, who was voted one of the 50 greatest players in the history of the NBA, died in Florida. He was 79.
There's an advertising war already underway for the 2020 presidential race, but you won't see it on the traditional TV airwaves. In fact, you might not see the ads at all. That's because they are narrowly targeted ads appearing on Facebook and Google. Here and Now media analyst John Carroll joins us with the details. Hi, John.
Hey, Jeremy.
So first of all, who is running these ads?
Yeah, who isn't? Party organizations are running them, special interest groups, but especially the presidential candidates. They're flooding Facebook and Google with ads that are really narrowly targeted. And the leader of the pack by far is Donald Trump.
And he used this a lot the last time around in 2016 as
Absolutely.
Well. According to a chart published by Axios, the Trump 2020 campaign has already spent over $8 million on Facebook and Google ads. Here's part of one ad.
When I took the oath of office, I swore to protect our country. And that is what I will always do. So help me God.
The ad then asked for a donation to secure the border fund, which has been, of course, a major talking point of his presidency.
Right. And that's one of the milder ads from Trump. Most of Trump's digital ads are about immigration, but a lot of them use what one report called nativist language. Interestingly, about half of the ads are targeted to people 65 and older.
Hmm.
Whose studies show are more likely to take what they see at face value. By contrast, only 27% of Democratic presidential candidates are targeting that 65-plus group.
And what about the Democratic presidential candidates? How much are they spending on digital ads?
About 12 of them combined have spent $9 million, so just a little bit more than Trump alone. Elizabeth Warren is the leader in terms of spending, which is interesting because she's actually run ads on Facebook calling for Facebook to be broken up. Facebook also owns Instagram, WhatsApp, and Messenger.
At least good for them for allowing them that ad to go on Facebook.
But on the other hand, last month they took those ads down for a short period of time when they said that they violated the platform's policy against using the Facebook logo.
Mm.
But when Politico reported on it, they put the ads back up.
Okay, so special interest groups have also invested in digital ads to the tune of $7.5 million.
Right. The advocacy groups, are doing really emotionally charged ads around issues like gun control. Mike Bloomberg's special interest group is spending money on that. The environment, even abortion rights are the subject of some of the ads. The biggest spender is California businessman and billionaire Tom Steyer, who's got a group called Need to Impeach. And here's how one of those ads begins.
When the history of the Trump presidency is written, members of Congress will be sorted into two categories. The ones who let politics scare them out of holding Trump accountable, and those who had the courage to stand up and defend our democracy.
interesting that Tom Steyer's running ads, because just today, President Trump tweeted out, weirdo Tom Steyer, who didn't have the guts or money to run for president, is still trying to remain relevant by putting himself on ads begging for impeachment. That's what do we know how effective these ads are that the special interest groups are putting out?
It's hard to say in that one. I mean, Tom Steyer has spent about $3.5 million on those
of his own money on
advertising. It's hard to say, but one of the things that you know for sure is that the targeting is really, really effective. So Donald Trump's 2020 campaign manager, Brad Parscale, has said that Facebook now lets you get to places that you would never go with TV ads. Now I can find 15 people on the Florida panhandle that I would never buy a TV commercial for. So it's a really effective way of delivering a message. And in many ways, it's sort of stealth advertising because only the people who are targeted see the ads. I should add that Facebook has introduced an ad library this year. So you can go and see all the ads that are that have been sent out. And it's interesting, just plug in Donald Trump and you'll see dozens and dozens of variations on the same ad using a little different language. There's different geography, and they can specify, what town you live in. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of it is really sophisticated.
That's a very interesting point that rather than buying ads in some big media market that you want to talk to, you can just go after the specific people in that market, and they may be no more expensive than the people who are in, let's say, rural Iowa.
Yeah. I mean, these are really cheap and really cost effective. And in a way, it's sort of the digital version of retail politics, the idea that you're going out and you're meeting people, you're contacting people individually and you know something about them and you can make it very relevant to them.
What percentage of ads are going to social media so far?
It used to be 5%. I think it's going to be up 35-40% this time.
35-40% of the money is going to social media ads.
I don't know that for a fact. I think that's the way it's going to shake out. Donald Trump will probably spend even more.
John Carroll, Here and Now media analyst. Thank you.
Thank you.
In New Orleans, the Jazz Festival turns 50 this weekend. It is the birthplace of jazz, the hometown of great musicians like Louis Armstrong and Irma Thomas, and many of them got their start in public schools. But since Hurricane Katrina, those schools have been run by charter organizations focused on boosting test scores in reading and math. Music isn't tested, and music education is not a priority in many of those schools. So now a group of veteran New Orleans musicians is trying to do something about that. Jess Clark from member station WWNO reports.
In the band room at Renew Dolores T. Aaron Academy, an elementary and middle charter school in New Orleans East, the brass band is doing some last-minute rehearsing before an upcoming talent show. They're working on Two New Orleans, a local standard. It's sounding okay, but suddenly the song falls apart. The band's instructor, Kevin Lewis, cuts them off and explains. This song has a traditional AABA form typical of New Orleans music, and some students are skipping a verse.
You see what I'm saying? AABA. You're going to play boo-dee-doo-dee-dee-da, boo-dee-doo-dee-dee-da, bee-dee-doo-dee.
Lewis knows what he's talking about. He's a trumpet player with the world-renowned Preservation Hall Jazz Band. He's working with these students as part of the Preservation Hall Foundation's Teaching Artist Program, which sends its musicians into public schools to beef up their music programs and teach New Orleans-style music. Lewis is helping out Dolores T. Aaron Band Director Andy Bauer. Bauer is from out of state and is glad to have Lewis's expertise.
The kids need to learn from New Orleans natives. Like, that's the way this music has always been taught.
Bauer says since he started the band program a few years ago, he's constantly had to fight for more funding. Ashley Shabankare is the director of programs for the Preservation Hall Foundation.
One of the big things that we saw as we evolved into the charter school movement was the de-evolution of what music classes were.
Shabankare says after Hurricane Katrina, music education took a back seat as schools focused on boosting math and reading scores. Many schools have only recently added back music programs, but generally, school administrators aren't making them a priority, often pulling kids out of band class for testing or extra help in reading or math.
I'm fortunate here that my administration is pretty receptive, there's been a lot of fighting to get to that point.
Statue said clap. So you watch the rest of the performance. At the end of each performance, you clap, got it?
Yes, sir!
All right.
Music programs in many schools are stretched thin. Most don't have a dedicated band room or enough instruments. And the ones they do have are in rough shape. Some of the instruments Bauer and Lewis's students are using are literally duct taped together. This tuba solo, for example. Fourteen-year-old Arnold Jackson played that riff on a tuba with a missing button. He takes it in stride.
That's all right. It's just, there's nothing wrong with it. As long as it keeps you like that, it's all good.
Arnold has been playing for 3 years, and he already knows he wants to be a professional musician. For him, band isn't just a hobby. It's training for a real career. It's the whole reason he comes to school. Arnold moves into position with the rest of the brass band for their talent show in the gym. The band brings a crowd of parents and students to their feet, despite the duct-taped mouthpieces and a few missing buttons. Trumpet player and instructor Kevin Lewis says struggle has always been a part of New Orleans musical tradition.
It's not like all the great musicians that came out of New Orleans had all the best instruments and like, you know, came from a bunch of money and had everything just laid out for them. You know, that's the story of the culture here. You know, it's a survival people.
With help from culture bearers like him, Lewis says he has faith New Orleans music will survive too. For Here and Now, I'm Jess Clark in New Orleans.
Earlier this week, the Saudi government beheaded 37 of its citizens on alleged terrorism charges. Amnesty International calls it a shocking execution spree based on sham trials. One person was publicly crucified, another arrested when he was just 17 years old. He was a student planning to come to the U.S. to study. Ali Al-Ahmed is director of the Gulf Institute in Washington. He is a critic of the Saudi government. Ali, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
By your count, 34 of the 37 people executed were minority Shiites. What else do you know about who they were?
This is the largest mass execution of Shia in Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the state. Most of these executed are protesters who were arrested between 2011 and 2016. For their participation in peaceful protest demanding jobs and development and democracy, parliament, and end to oppression. There are some professionals, one religious leader who was an English professor as well. Most of them were below 30. One I knew actually personally, Abdullah Surayh, a young man, he was unemployed and he was one of the leaders of the protest, and he gave many wonderful speeches about an elected parliament, national unity, and I translated his speech. He said to the police, "We are not your enemy. The enemy is the one who put your brothers in prison." And he asked for a democracy and elected parliament and so on.
Now, the government has said that some of the people executed had killed security officers. Some had sowed sectarian tensions. A number were convicted of spying for Iran. What do you make of those charges? Is there any truth to them at all?
You cannot trust the Saudi government when it charges its dissidents with crimes, because if you remember what happened with Khashoggi, where they said, you know, that he left the consulate and then he died of due to a fight, and then, you know, the story changes every day.
This is the Washington Post journalist who was killed.
Exactly.
In Istanbul,
so right? That gives you really an example of how the Saudi government operates. I was a political prisoner myself, and I saw that, how they stick a charge on you. The Saudis now taking advantage of the American-Iranian tensions and sticking everybody to Iran, because that gives them the cover, the American cover, and that's why there hasn't been reaction from the American officialdom regarding this mass execution.
Well, as you know, a very similar thing happened in 2016 when a prominent Shia cleric was executed along with 46
yes.
others. And I know you've said that this is a politically motivated message to Iran. What do you mean by that?
It is a message. The Saudis always like to tag Iran to this. These kids have never been to Iran, let alone have any connection with Iran. The Iranian government reaction to this execution has been muted. But the Saudis take advantage of the American-U.S. tensions and accuse everybody of being an Iranian agent or Iranian proxy. That's just the way they operate.
Talk more about this connection in your mind to the United States policy in Saudi Arabia, which, as we know, has basically turned a blind eye to many of the human rights violations under the Trump administration. How is that connected, or is it at all?
It is connected. The United States is the main guarantor of the security of the Saudi monarchy. Because of that relationship, the U.S. has not demanded or pushed for any progress in that front, even with basic things like even for, I would dare to say, for Americans who live in Saudi Arabia who cannot celebrate 4th of July or Thanksgiving openly. They have to do it in secret.
What do the Saudi people make of all of this? You know, on the one hand, maybe they feel protected against terrorism. On the other, it must be terrifying to see someone publicly crucified, their body on a spear. I mean, what do the people think of this?
The public execution in Saudi Arabia, this is maybe the only country in the world that carries on public executions in the streets. The Saudi monarchy uses it to send a message of fear and intimidation to the public.
So does it work? Of
course it's working, because this is now the highest level of fear I have seen in my country over the past 50 years, and I dare say since the foundation of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. So it is a message to kill people in mass using a very graphic way of doing it. It is a message, it's a way to control society, because society, they want to change, and that's why you see a lot of people in Saudi prisons. You're talking about, you know, maybe over 10,000 political prisoners of various backgrounds, and this is the highest level of intimidation, oppression, imprisonment, and obviously executions of political prisoners. We have not seen this even under the dark years of King Faisal, who did not carry on mass executions like MBS is doing.
Ali Al-Ahmed, director of the Gulf Institute in Washington. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And we reached out to the Saudi embassy. An official told us the kingdom has zero tolerance for terrorists who spill the blood of the innocent. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.